Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Gambling is an ever-present problem in our society, and even more so when you listen to our conversation today on the podcast with Professor Michael Badgen, the psychiatrist and addiction medicine specialist. He's the head of the statewide gambling therapy service at the Flinders Centre for Gambling Research. And we'll be speaking about what does define gambling and what can you do about it. Gambling, something that is in lots of people's lives, and it touches some of our lives. Michael, you've been involved in this for a long time. Tell us what's led you to be involved in this as a speciality with your background in psychiatry.
Oh, boy, it started way back. So in the 90s, at the beginning of the 90s, I finished training in psychiatry. But before I did do psychiatry, I worked for a little while on drug and alcohol, and out of that developed an interest in addictions and things that went with addictions, behavioural addictions and substance addictions. I did a little bit of research. At the end of my training, from there, my interest grew. I went to work at Flinders as a specialist. One of my colleagues, Professor Malcolm Battersby, was very interested in evidence-based therapies for anxiety disorders. I joined up with him. And over the next decade or so, treating people with anxiety disorders, there are a lot of similarities that you could find between people who had an anxiety disorder, like an obsessive-compulsive disorder, and a gambling disorder in the way you would treat obsessive compulsive disorder. You could apply it to gambling treatment. So the statewide gambling therapy service arose out of an interest from our department in addressing gambling as an issue. And then it was funded by Jay Weatherill in the early days of pokies being introduced, and it's been running for well over 25 years now. So it's a fascinating area, behavioural addictions, and gambling is a good example of it.
Michael, I did actually hear the other day that Australia's economy is propped up by real estate, and one of the others is gambling.
Yeah. I can never quite get my head around the figures, but a surprising percentage of each state's income, except Western Australia, is derived from gambling revenue. And it is of the order of 10 or 15%. It is absolutely astonishing. And people often say that state governments are addicted to the revenue from gambling problems. The problem with it is that the people who provide most of that revenue are the least able to afford to do so. They're the ones that have the gambling problems, and they're being wrung dry, really. So it's grossly unfair.
So, Michael, let's just unpack that. When we talk about gambling addiction, are we talking all types of gambling, like even you've got horses, you've got all these sports bets, you've got pokies, it encapsulates it all?
Yeah, look, there's obviously a range of behaviours that you can use to gamble with, you know, scratchies, lotteries, all the way through to horses, dogs, people will bet on two flies out a window, that kind of thing as well. But if we're looking across the population, the majority of the population in Australia do gamble. We, in fact, spend the most in the world per capita, or lose most in the world per capita on gambling. And 70% of the population actually gamble, but the majority of people are doing, you know, the occasional scratchy or lottery ticket. They're not gambling on a regular basis, fortunately. So there's a real spectrum of gambling.
Interestingly, Michael, people who buy a scratchy or a lottery ticket wouldn't consider themselves gamblers often, I'm sure.
No, they're just hoping to have a big windfall, to retire early or do whatever they want to do. Look, 40% of the population actually gamble more than weekly. And if you're in that vicinity, you are bound to have a problem arising from it of some form. If we were to look at the really tricky end of the gambling spectrum, the people with what we call a gambling disorder, which is a recognised mental illness in the International Classification of Diseases, we're looking at anywhere between 0.5% and 5%, depending on which research you're looking at in Australia. So it is a big, big problem. It's on par with schizophrenia, rates of schizophrenia, and it has an enormous cost to the community. There's been research done looking at the harms from gambling and looking at when that sort of kicks in and looking at correlates with the frequency of your gambling and the amount that you spend. And a researcher in Melbourne called Nikki Dowling did some research that was originally done in Canada and applied it to Australia, and that looked at the kind of surveys that showed how many problems arose from gambling, and then related it to the frequency of gambling behaviours and the amount of money lost in gambling. And the kind of figures that came out in that research was that if you're gambling more than 30 times a year, if you're spending more than $600 a year, or if you're regularly gambling in two or more types of gambling modalities a year, you are very, very likely to have or develop a problem from your gambling. And the problems that arise from gambling, you know, vary enormously from person to person, but we're talking about relationships problems, you know, emotional, psychological problems, surprisingly physical health problems, because people will often, if they get into real strife, they'll often not eat healthily, they'll get involved with staying up all night, gambling, all these things lead to bad health. Financial, obviously, criminal, cultural, forsaking study and work, and so all these problems. And you know, the relationship's probably the most common one that we see. But so if you're gambling above those levels, you're at a really increased risk of developing a problem from one of those areas. Looking at it another way, about 80% of people who report gambling more than weekly experience clear harm as a result of their gambling.
And when you say clear harm, in what way does that harm manifest?
Well, their partner says, I'm going to leave you because you're still gambling. You said you wouldn't, but you've gone down to the pub again. Or what's happened to our rent money? It's gone. Or ducking off at lunchtime from work into the pub to use the poker machine. Even down to the worst end of the spectrum, you know, people who get involved in criminal activity to fund the gambling. But the absolute worst harm is the suicidal thoughts, which our own research, you know, shows is very, very high in people who come for treatment. It's about 80% of people have thoughts of suicide when they're presenting for treatment, so they're people with gambling disorder. And actually, there was a study done a couple of years ago that looked at all the deaths from suicide in Victoria over about a decade or so, and it showed that 4% of them were related to gambling problems.
Interesting. And Michael, how does this impact on the people that gambler would be in relationships with? For example, how does someone know if they're living with a gambler and what is it like for them?
Yeah, well, it's enormously problematic. Having a gambling disorder is almost incompatible with a stable relationship, because the person with the gambling disorder will lie to conceal their gambling behaviour, because the person they're with worries about them and they try to encourage them not to gamble. They'll often make a promise they won't gamble. They'll break that promise. They will sometimes divert the money that they've got in a shared account, or pinch things or hock things, take possessions and sell them to fund the gambling with the intention of paying it all back. You know, the idea is that you gamble more to win your money back that you've lost through gambling, which is a big part of the problem. So you can imagine if you've got somebody that's doing this sort of stuff behind your back and repeatedly you ask them to stop and they say they will. After a while, you absolutely lose faith in them. And you start to dislike them, and the dislike reaches a point where people say, that's the end of it, I can't tolerate it. Well, a percentage of that, of the 4% who died from suicides in that Melbourne study, were not the gamblers too. There's about, I think it was about 8% from memory, were actually significant others related to the person who gambled.
Was that through violence, or could have just been not because they were violent, it was just the behaviour of the gambler that led them to it?
That's right, yeah. Mainly the misery that arises as a result of the loved others' gambling behaviour. Although there is a relationship that's been shown between gambling problems and domestic violence, that has been shown, yeah.
We're talking today to Professor Michael Bajan, who's a psychiatrist and addiction medicine specialist, and he works with the statewide gambling therapy service. Michael, how would you know if you were living with a gambler? So, hadn't come up as obvious, what would be the signs you'd need to look for?
I suppose puzzling absences, funds disappearing, person asking for money when they're, you know, repeatedly, you know, they're visiting their friends, late nights, unaccountably, preoccupation with things, frequent checking of the phone if it's a sports betting thing, looking for results, ducking off down the road to the TAB, although that's a bit less common, going to gaming venues at irregular hours, those kind of things. So people work very hard to conceal it from the other people. They're often very ashamed of their behaviour. But sooner or later it does come out, and it's often a big shock to the person that their loved one has been gambling to the extent they have.
And do you think that mobile phones have exacerbated the access to gambling with all of the online? I mean, I look at these sports bet ads and they make people look successful, popular, it's fun, certainly no detractor that this isn't something someone should be doing.
No, absolutely. They're working very hard to normalise the behaviour, and it's taking hold amongst the young people. The rise of sports betting through mobile phones, predominantly, has been incredible. Most of it is online. It's gone up 60% since 2015. It is a problem amongst young men where it's a normalised behaviour. It's sort of thought to go with sport, which is a horrible sort of outcome. You know, people think that you've got to have a bet to enjoy the sport. You know, about a fifth of the males between 18 and 34 are actually problem gamblers on sports betting.
That's terrible statistics. Michael, how does therapy help? What sort of programs are available, and what sort of treatment, I guess? What do you do?
Well, look, I suppose the first thing to say is that people with gambling disorder actually have impaired control over the gambling. They're no longer in the space to just stop. As much as they want to, and they do want to, they are not in that space. And they give priority to gambling over other activities. And they keep going despite the problems that it's causing. They're off in the back of their mind. They're thinking they're going to win it all back and life will be better. So at that end of the spectrum, you need treatment. You need evidence-based therapy. I'll talk about that in a second if you like.
But yes,
people are still gambling at a lesser level. So they're, you know, they might be going every second week. They're spending a little bit more than they need to. And it's causing a bit of friction with their family or partners. They probably don't need the therapy itself, the intensive therapy, but they can put in place a lot of safeguards. They can put in place self-banning in various ways. There's an online thing you can do. You can ban yourself from venues and take different steps like that and get some financial counselling and get some support. But once it's become an addiction, at that end of the spectrum, the step that you need to take is a more intense step with proper therapy and proper treatment. The idea that you can just avoid going to the venue, you know, someone might go along and see somebody and say, I've got a gambling problem, I can't stop gambling, and the person says, well, here's a bright idea. Just don't go to the hotel where you gamble. That on its own isn't going to work. It will work for very small percentages of people because the urge is so strong, they'll overcome it in one way or another. They need specific treatment. That's therapy. Medication hasn't really been shown to be effective.
So is this where the obsessive compulsive behaviour comes in, like they just have to gamble because they think if I don't gamble, I've missed out on an opportunity to win the money back?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because when you treat somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder, which I'm involved in as well, I run a clinic up at Flinders for that, for anxiety disorders, there's anxiety that arises from the obsessional thought. For example, you've got germs on your hands and it grows and grows and grows, and then you think, well, I've got to get rid of that feeling. The anxiety is so bad. And so the person will then go and wash their hands and get rid of it. And that actually perpetuates the hand washing. It doesn't help to get rid of the worry that you've got germs on your hands. All it does is it reduces the anxiety from that thought, and it causes you to want to wash your hands again and again and again. In a similar way with gambling, once you've got an established gambling disorder, the urge to gamble increases. It's prompted by various different cues, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling. So people get this urge that's sort of like a gnawing, uncomfortable feeling. And although it's not identical to anxiety, it's a kind of an anxiety feeling. And so they'll get rid of it when they go and gamble. It actually alleviates that feeling once they've got the gambling disorder. And it reinforces the behaviour of gambling and makes it more frequent and more likely when they get the urge. So what we do in treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder is, in a graded way, you'll get the person to expose themselves to the things that make them get the anxiety about having germs in their hands. You start with a very low-level prompt, and you get them to get the feeling, and then with their understanding of what they're doing, they resist that urge to go and wash their hands. We get them to do that a couple of times a day, repeatedly, and after a while that urge goes, that anxiety goes with that prompt. So you could probably see how you'd apply it to gambling. People who, say, use poker machines will often find a variety of things trigger the urge to go and gamble or to gamble and put money into the machine and so forth. So we might start with, say, a photo of the machine that they really like. That'll get them very excited about gambling, and they usually get a very strong urge. And they're aware that they're deliberately provoking the urge, but the outcome of it is not to go and gamble and wait for the urge to go away. And so we get them to do that repeatedly until the picture of the machine no longer causes the urge. And then you gradually move up a hierarchy. And ultimately we have people who sitting in front of the machine, for example, they've got it loaded with money, they're feeling an urge, they withstand that and they do that repeatedly, and eventually the urge goes. and they're not preoccupied anymore with gambling, and they're better.
And there is evidence base behind this type of therapy, you were saying, Michael?
Yeah, there is. There are two approaches that have evidence for them. One is our approach, another one is a cognitive approach, looking at the thoughts that people have. We've conducted trials, comparison trials at an international level, comparing our approach to cognitive therapy approach, and it works as well, and probably lasts a little bit longer than cognitive therapy.
So how do people get support, Michael, both the person who's living with the gambler and the gambler themselves?
We've just finished recruiting for a study. Dr. Ben Riley is leading it in part of our unit, and it's looking at how you can help the gambler who's insightless and resistant to getting treatment through the significant other. So there are ways that you can actually help the person to come into treatment when they're not sure, and a bit reluctant, a bit insightless, and that's around understanding how it all works and reinforcing the right sort of behaviours heading in the right direction towards treatment. The family members can always contact Gambling Helpline. I can't tell you the number, but it's easily found on the internet. People with the disorder can contact Gambling Helpline, or they can make a self-referral to our gambling service, the Statewide Gambling Therapy Service. The contact details are online, you can search it out. But if you've got a gambling disorder itself, you really need to have evidence-based treatment, and unfortunately medication hasn't been shown to be very effective, and it is therapy.
Well, interesting, Michael. I think a lot of people would not have put themselves in as a gambler, but with your statistics that you've just offered today, maybe that might change. Professor Michael Pagent, this has been a really interesting interview, and I know our community centres often have people coming to their doors with these types of issues, or family members who have someone exhibiting it. So it's of real interest today that we were able to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Kerry.
Community Centre Catch-Ups. Touching base. Keeping our ear to the ground across SA.
Kate Martin, who's coordinator of the York Peninsula Southern Community Hub. Welcome to the podcast, Kate.
Thanks, Kerry.
Tell us about your centre there. What are the programs that you're running? And I know you've had a few, been in the news about the internet difficulties, so must be challenging.
Yes, it is. We're very much a rural centre. The Southern York Peninsula is actually classified in most of the government systems as being remote, which seems a bit strange when you first talk about it, because we're only by road about 3 hours from Adelaide, and if we had a helicopter or a boat, we could be in Adelaide in about 20 minutes to half an hour by the sea. But it can at times be very remote to the services despite that. So we are an agent for Centrelink and also for Service SA, because the nearest actual customer service centres are in Cadena, which is an hour and a half from us here in Yorktown. And for people that live down the bottom end of the York Peninsula, is a good 2-3 hour drive away. So for people from there to get to Cadena would be like asking someone in the middle of Adelaide to go down to Cadena for their essential services that they need. So we have for many years provided an agency here for those services. We were originally established back in 2000 as what they called at the time Community Telecentre. They had a focus on helping the community with technology as it was emerging, so internet, home computers. We still do those, certainly the weekly computer class and digital technology class is a big thing for us. But we also expanded back in 2018, which is when our name changed from Community Telecentre to Community Hub, because as the, I guess, generations were moving on and we were getting more people that had grown up using digital technology, the need for that assistance is getting less, but there has been a need for more wider sort of community support and assistance. So back in 2018, the committee decided to expand us as a community centre, and about the same time, Yorktown was the scene of the first Black Summer fires back in 2019, and that sort of then sent us into a community resilience recovery building role.
So you're a real central link then, Kate, for the York Peninsula as such, and as you always say, nowhere's really close to anywhere, because if you're down the bottom, you're not near the top, and if you are in the middle, you're still a long way away.
That's right. And as far as government services go, we are in the same region as the Mid-North, so any services tend to be headquartered in Port Pirie, with a satellite office at Kadena, with a worker that comes down to the southern part of the peninsula once a month, or even less, sometimes just when required.
And despite that though, Kate, you still run a number of programs servicing the community. So just walk us through what programs you're offering.
So, we have community, what we call generally community resilience program. That can be very responsive to what the needs in the community are at the time. So we had, as you sort of touched on before, the last month we've been having power issues on the Southern York Peninsula, which culminated in a day where there was no power for 20 hours or more. And when the power went down, so did the communication abilities. The towers all shut down, so we had no ability to communicate within the peninsula or outside the peninsula, other than in the few locations that had a GRN radios. So we will help people with getting prepared. So like what we're looking at doing now is a program to sort of, what are the resources that we have on the peninsula that we could utilise should something happen again? We work closely with organisations like CFS, SES, all the emergency services, our local council, to try kind of bring everyone together and lead a community effort into what we could do. We also have programs around supporting NDIS. So once a month, we have the local VAPT care, whose local area coordinator lady comes down here to be available for people. We also do a little bit of support through NDIS as well. We have now Uniting Community Legal Centre come down once a month for an outreach program, which is something, I guess, that's been really heartened me is when that program started, because I can remember probably 2.5 years ago trying to get some legal support for a single mother who was in a domestic violence situation, and being told by somebody on the phone who had no idea of geography, well, she can just drop into our office at Port Pirie. And I said, well, no, actually, she can't, because do you know how far Port Pirie is away from Yorktown? So to be able to get that service happening down here has been one of the achievements that I'm really happy that we've been able to do.
It was a credit to you, Kate, and this is the sort of thing I wanted to highlight, is the challenge for regional areas in South Australia, and you are doing a great job. So thank you so much for sharing that, and for a story that you felt really pleased that you can do something with. Really appreciate you being on the podcast, and people are down Kate's way, pop in and say hello.
Thanks, Kerry.
And thank you for listening and engaging with our community conversations today. Every week, we aim to bring you stories from far and wide across South Australia and beyond. People who are game changers in our community, doing great work, plus general topics of community interest. If you have any subjects you think we should cover or any other feedback, please let us know at communitycentressa.asn.au. And feel free to share this podcast so we can engage more people in our next community conversation.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.